You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back for another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. In this episode, I talk about a new HBO docuseries called How to Create a Sex Scandal. And I wanted to give you fair warning. This is not to be listened to in the accompaniment of children. So if you're in the car or in a room with them, I turn it off and then maybe listen a little bit later. This story first surfaced in a Texas Monthly article. In 2005, a sleepy community, Mineola, Texas, is thrown into turmoil when three local children revealed shocking stories about a pedophile ring that took place at a local swingers club. Imagine it. August 11th, 2004, those that were reading the Mineola Monitor, a weekly newspaper that serves much of Wood County in East Texas, get to the second page, and next to the letters to the editor, they come across a story titled Sex in the City, in which columnist Gary Edwards reveals that a club for swingers and swappers was operating in town. The club was called The Retreat, and there were 12 rooms, two hot tubs, a karaoke machine, a stereo, a big screen TV, a sex swing, and a lot of beds. We'll do the operators of the facility a favor, he said, and we won't say where it's located for now. If they just move quietly out into the country, we'll try and forget they've infiltrated our town with their set of moral standards. Well, swinger clubs are legal in Texas as long as no one is soliciting or paying for sex. And after this column came to light, this became something of an open secret in town. But this lifestyle was not shared by the majority of people in the town, a town that only has 5,600 people and has quite a bit of Baptist churches and antique stores. Then on June 22nd of 2005, a woman named Margie Cantrell, who had moved from Mineola from California just a year before, walks into the police station with a shocking story about this place called The Retreat. Margie and her husband, John, were career foster parents, and after arriving in town, had taken in four new kids. And as Margie explained it to the on-duty officer, one of her new foster daughters had told her that she and her six-year-old brother, so an eight-year-old girl and her six-year-old brother, had been forced to perform sex shows at this swingers club. But the police couldn't find any evidence or any other witnesses, and the investigation was dropped. 5 months later, the case resurfaces in Smith County, Wood County's neighbor to the south. And this time, the Texas Rangers were called in, and the story got even crazier. The kids apparently had been taught sexual dancing, and they had been forced to have sex with each other at a sex kindergarten. This is run by a man, they said, was named Booger Red. And after graduating, they were made to dance, strip, play doctor, and have sex with each other at the club. The shows were videotaped, and in order to break down the kids' inhibitions, they were drugged with Vicodin. According to the allegations, there were half a dozen adults involved in this operation, which included Chantel Mayo, Jamie Pittman, who was her boyfriend, and Sheila Stones, the kids' maternal grandmother, the kids that came in to report this. many of the accused had drug or alcohol problems. So investigators followed the case for a year and a half, and once again, there was no physical evidence or adult witnesses that were discovered. But in July of 2007, arrest warrants were issued for six people, including the children's mother, Chantal Mayo, Pittman, her boyfriend, the maternal grandmother, and Booger Red, who was a red-haired body shop sandblaster whose real name was Patrick Kelly, which was rarely used even by his family. These charges shocked all of East Texas, six indicted in child sex ring. Had they actually done what they were accused of doing? As arrests were made, life sentences were handed down, and lives were ruined. And it soon becomes apparent that there's a lot more to the story than meets the eye. With more twists and turns than a Hollywood thriller, How to Create a Sex Scandal is a startling and scarcely believable telling of a crime story that is really stranger than fiction. The question is, did this actually happen? So Max presents How to Create a Sex Scandal. It is produced by Talus Films in association with Texas Monthly, who wrote all those really well-done articles. It is directed by Julian Hobbs and executive producers Elia Kami and Julian. And they've been on my show before. They talked about House of Hammer. They are excellent at what they do. This is three episodes. They are not to be missed. And this story is the most bizarre. I can't even begin to tell you. And so here is my interview with the filmmakers. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today. How to Create a Sex Scandal. Where did you find the story?
Well, I am a huge fan of Texas Monthly's true crime reporting. Mm-hmm. I have been for a very long time. And, you know, as you know, with House of Hammer and Queen of Meth, we're always looking to find a riveting three-part true crime miniseries. And as I was sifting through the Texas Monthly archives, I saw a headline that said "The Girl Who Told the Truth." And it immediately grabs my attention. And when I started to read the article, you know, what I discovered was just jaw-dropping, that at the center of it was a young woman named Gabby Soans. And at 7 years old, she believed that her parents had put her into a sex ring in a swingers club. But then when she was 16 years old, she realized that her memory may have deceived her. And when I read the article, the one thing that I recognized was that there was definitely a narrative that was taking place where you could take the viewer on a ride where you were questioning memory and questioning what was real and what was not real and what was truth and what was false. And, you know, really kind of play with what's happening and what's really happening and what didn't happen. And you could kind of arc that over the course of three episodes in a way that the viewer would experience what the people that lived through this sex scandal experienced as they experienced it. And that was very intriguing to me in terms of a larger vision for how to lay out a true crime narrative. So that's kind of how we found the story. And we went to Texas Monthly and they said, yeah, we'd love to partner with you and go on this journey with you. But Julian, I think, had a, you know, he had a different, I think, take than I did when I found the story and what attracted him to this crazy story in Mineola, Texas.
Well, no, I mean, I loved it. And that story was part of three pieces of journalism that Mike Hall from Texas Monthly did over about a 6-year period from, you know, the roughly 2007, 2008 up to around 2013, mm-hmm. which told this amazing story in Mineola about what he laid out to be a miscarriage of justice, which we can unpack what that is and how that worked and who the players were. I love stories that involve elements of mass hysteria. We've done a film on the Salem witch trials. I think it's, you know, everyone now says fake news so much so that we don't know what is fake and what is real, and it gets reappropriated and reused. And just the political climate and the cultural climate that we live in has reached a point where kind of mass hysteria seems to be part of our daily lives. What's really interesting is to drop into a small community where you can see those dynamics at play in a very localized way, in which groupthink institutions fall in line around essentially a self-generated mythology. Mm-hmm. And what's the fallout from that? And what are the power dynamics that create that? And how can we not just look at them and say, oh, look at those crazies in East Texas, but realize that that could be any of us at any point, anywhere. So that's that was my interest in it, beyond just as Ellie laid out. It's a ripping yarn.
So it begins, this criminal tragedy begins in 2005 when Margie Cantrell, a career foster mom, who either fled or migrated from California to Texas in 2004, walks into the Mineola Police Department, which is located in Wood County, just north of Tyler, and informs the police that two of her foster children have been forced to perform sex shows at the Retreat Club, a local swingers club. First question I have for you is, why did she leave California?
Well, that's an interesting question, yeah.
Things that she told us when we interviewed her, and I do think it's remarkable that Margie does appear in our film. I think she was looking for a quieter life. They had in California fostered many children, and they were looking to retire. And so they found this beautiful lake house. Mineola, Texas is a lake community. And they found a beautiful lake house that they felt that they could, you know, move into a community and, you know, start to slow down their lives. And as Margie told us in the interview, what attracted her to this life was its peacefulness. But her children said, Mom, you know, you're a great foster mother, and we think that you should take up fostering children here in Mineola as well. And so she did. And again, that's what her account of how she came from California to Texas was.
What is interesting too is you do a great job of opening with her and you get kind of warmed up to her. And then immediately there's someone else that goes, I liked her the first 15 minutes, and then I realized it's the Margie show. What was your experience with her? Because again, to your point, I'm astounded that she participated.
To be good journalists, which we have to do when you tell these stories, all sides need to be invited to participate in the film. And often people choose not to. Armie Hammer did not participate in House of Hammer. Guess we're not too surprised about that, but we did invite him to participate in that film. And so, you know, Margie strongly believes her point of view. And therefore, we had to provide her, when she raised her hand, a platform to lay out her point of view. Quite frankly, I think it makes for a much more interesting film when you can see both sides of that. And ultimately, we'll leave it up to the viewers to decide where they fall on this. Mike Hall's journalism stands to this day as, I think, painting a picture of deception on the part of Margie. But she has not been found guilty of a crime. She has not gone to jail for these actions. And what's remarkable in the town itself is a certain amnesia. And that's the other interesting thing about the Why Now. You know, we went there 9 years after this blow up had all happened, and Margie bailed out of town in 2013. The majority of the town folk that we spoke to still believe that there was a pedophile ring at the at the Swingers Club and that these people rightfully went to jail. The local district attorney and judicial system and the Texas Rangers has not taken any accountability for what went down, admitted any form of guilt or wrongdoing. And in fact, as you know, these parents still have a felony charge on their record, which is highly disruptive to their lives. And one person who was convicted and sent to jail ultimately died of COVID there in the last year and was never released. So I guess that's to say, you know, we can come in and tell you what the truth is, but a lot of people believe in another version of the truth. And back to Ellie's point, that's some of the tension in the film. You know, how do different truths coexist in the same world, in the same community?
What was the mindset in Mineola at that time when the story came out about sexual abuse?
They were outraged. One of the reporters who we spoke to, who actually reported on the case, she grew up in Mineola. And so she was assigned this story. And the one thing that she told us was that the community just felt incredibly heartbroken for the children, of course, but they also demonized and vilified the parents. I mean, they were probably the worst form of human being that anyone could imagine. And the community came after them very hard because they believed, as Julie and I have been saying, this quote unquote truth that children were being taken into a swingers club by their parents in Texas, and they were forced to perform sex acts with each other. And that parents would do this to their children, the community just completely wanted to see them get locked up and put away for life.
Right. And I mean, that's the interesting thing. So that urge for justice, that urge to protect the children, save the children, children is a human urge. You can say, it's where people should fall. It takes a village to protect children. It also takes a village to create mass hysteria. And the mass hysteria was planted in my mind, and I think this is brought out by Mike Hall, around the notion of a swingers club in a very conservative town.
Right.
Now, swingers club it's very Texan. So there's a libertarian side to Texas. So swingers club are legal. The swingers were doing nothing illegal. There's nothing illegal about people getting together and swinging. It's choice. This is what they do. The slippage is in most people's minds, swingers and pedophiles are just a small shift away. Of course, there were pedophiles. So once that little seed had been planted, according to Mike Hall, by Margie, that door was open for the pitchforks to come out to some degree, because people were inclined. The narrative went down a very slippery slope. Swingers club, pedophiles, people who live in trailer parks from the wrong side of the tracks. So this path made it very easy suddenly to go down a scapegoating path. And find, and say, oh my God, evils visit us and we have to drive it out and hold them accountable, and try them in the town square. So that mentality took hold.
Also because Margie is an outsider and she says, I came to this community because it seemed like a very tight-knit, close-knit community with conservative value system. And then the people that are targeted, as you mentioned, live in trailers. It would be an easy thing for people to see that there was a sequence of events that would make this story believable. How did this shake people in the state that this could have happened?
I think there's collective amnesia in the state. I honestly think that the state's response is noteworthy for its lack of response and lack of responsibility to a judicial system that became unhinged. I mean, back to people taking responsibility, there's also the notion that when you are a elected district attorney and you say, I'm going to drive out the pedophile swingers and save the children, there's a lot of stickiness to your future political life to do something like that, right? So people have a stake and they have rewards for carrying this out. As the local news reporter said, her newsroom said, every night we need to have another story on that swingers club. And they were all found guilty before they even went to trial by the local media. So lots of people begin to benefit by this. And then when it dissipates like a pop of a balloon and it goes away, people don't want to talk about it anymore. The news cycle moves on, but I also think there's a certain degree of let's just forget about that. You know what I mean? It's because the ramifications of taking responsibility would be damaging to a lot of people in power who should know better than what happened, quite frankly.
Do you think that it dissuaded people in the aftermath of fostering children?
Ellie?
I think that's a great question. I think probably not would be my gut instinct on that, because I think that, you know, that people had their own individual motivations for becoming a foster parent. And I think that this was an isolated case within a community, in an individual family that needed foster care for specific reasons. So I don't think it was something that maybe had a negative impact for others in terms of taking in children who have need. I think that that is something that people, you know, I don't think people turn their backs on that.
It wasn't as one of the parents says, we're poor people and we had poor people problems. There were issues of drug abuse and in the household. There were government agencies that were looking closely at those families and watching the kids, and ultimately at one time did remove the kids prior to the swingers club coming up and place them in foster care, which may have been the right response. So I wouldn't blame the foster care system. It's what kind of happened in this unique cauldron of events that those kids were placed within the Cantrells. And then the story really gets going from there. Right.
I think I don't know if it discouraged people from becoming foster parents, but I hope the one thing that the case did do is to make sure that the people who are taking in children in the foster care system are adequately background checked, mm-hmm. or adequately, you know, looked at in terms of, are these people fit to be taking in children that have, you know, that have real issues and that have real needs.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KKC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KKC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/KKC.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Did you get a sense at all that there's a possibility that Margie Cantrell may have been a childhood abuse survivor?
She never told us that. And I think, we could psychologize Margie Cantrell. And obviously Ellie and I have talked a lot about it. I don't know if that's useful here, because I kind of would like the viewers to engage in the show and draw their conclusions. She never gave us any indication of that. She grew up, you know, as she would put it, in a religious and loving family. She, She wanted to be an actress. She had dreams. She saw adopting children as part of a larger mission to, you know, to help society and as part of kind of a religious calling. But the facts as laid out by Mike Hall and others and the oral testimony in our film would say that there's something deeply troubling psychologically going on.
Absolutely.
There. And what triggered that and why that is. And why Margie would say that that's not true, despite what seems to be a preponderance of evidence to say that something really did go awry here, is part of the tension of the story, quite frankly, right?
And how is it possible that she could make nearly $110,000 during a 1.5 year period fostering the three children?
Well, that was definitely something that many of our experts spoke about who were within the legal system. Also, the children to this day, Gabby speaks about, the Soames family speaks about, which is that when children are more troubled and have problems, greater mental health needs, the foster parents are actually given more money to take in those children. So if you are given more money for five children, those dollars can add up very quickly.
And then what is the relationship that her biological children now have with Margie? Has that been clouded by all of this?
No.
They adore her.
Yeah. As far as, you know, and Jacob appears in our film, and we didn't, I will say this, outside of the film, we talked to other foster children. We wanted to talk to all of them. Some have, there's of course, Jenna's in the film and plays an important role in the film at the end of the first episode about revealing alleged abuse. It's alleged because no one ever was guilty of that within the Cantrell household. We talked to Jacob. We interviewed another daughter who she was actually a foster kid, ultimately didn't make it into the film. Jacob is highly supportive now, but if you listen to the kids in the household, the adopted kids, they said there was a hierarchy in that household.
Right.
Biological kids were upstairs and they were in the basement. And in a way, they were the servants serving the Cantrells and their kids. And then there was a pecking order going on there. However, the Cantrell, at least Jacob Cantrell, is very supportive of his parents and believes that the deception and the lies are coming from the adopted children.
Wild. It'll be interesting once this comes out if that changes at all.
Well, I still think there's a huge responsibility on the state to take responsibility. These people should have felony charges removed from their record. And I think part of the danger when they do that, by the way, is that then the state could stand liable for a civil case to bring damages, right? Which often happens. So, there's many reasons, probably some financial, why the state doesn't want to take responsibility, and others just quite frankly, I would almost go as far as to say, embarrassment or just the inability to acknowledge that there was a miscarriage of justice that happened here.
Yeah, I think that really, there's two things I think when we got to the end of the narrative that I think are very important to, put forward and, shed light on. And one is that the people who got hurt tremendously were the children. And, they're young adults today, but they have to live with this unbelievable, just tragedy that they had to go through to put their parents away in jail, testify against their own family, and then recall their memory and realize that didn't happen. And that has scarred them. I mean, it would scar anybody. So the children really are the ones who got harmed here. And also the parents who were then, took plea deals for the right reasons, for the reasons to protect their children, now have to live with the stigma of a crime that they didn't commit. And so they carry that baggage with them. And I think that when we got to the end of the story, that's what we think is the important thing to look at and say, is there anything that we can do right in this situation by these people? I think that is a very important question to ask.
I think you can see that Hunter, all of them, Gabby was outside the household, mm-hmm. but And Shelby, the oldest child, it should be stated for the record, has not recanted like her younger brother Hunter and younger sister Carly, both of who participated in the film. So there's an older sister, Shelby, who did not participate, who has never recanted. So that should be stated. I look at someone like Hunter as a troubled young man and a haunted young man. And I wish him all the best, but it's horrifying what he went through. And it's very scary when you realize that not only was your childhood stolen from you, but your mind and your memory and who you are was reprogrammed. So, and you have that very moving scene, I think, where he reads what he said when he was a young boy in that courtroom while his mom was sitting in the docket that sent her to jail for life.
Yeah.
To reflect back on the fact that that was implanted in him and that he carried out that act, I think is hugely undermines a sense of self. And I think this raises some larger issues about who we are and how our memories function. And maybe, you know, how close this is kind of like a Blade Runner story of, you know, you could be a replica, something implanted in you. And who are you really? But I think to have that happen to you personally in such an extreme fashion as this undermines your self identity and creates some real psychological issues down the road, obviously.
And also just reiterates the fragility of the mind.
Yeah, well, it's a big part of this. And this is why this is like at the tail of the satanic panic era, you know, which bloomed in the late 1970s. And there's been a lot of studies and books written about this. And that started in Southern California. It was the first case there, all the way through films like Paradise Lost. This was a huge phenomenon, which across the countries, hundreds and hundreds of people were sent to jail on the idea that they were performing satanic rituals. It usually happened with children. You see a lot of similar traits with this story and that kind of satanic panic syndrome.
Yeah.
And it's interesting when these syndromes pop up and then they begin, after a while, they begin to burn out. And there's been a lot of books on sociology about why that happened. That's all of interest. But lots of times it's during periods of deep social change and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Often it comes when suddenly people have to confront an other and the other suddenly becomes an alien and then can be demonized. And I think that's close to where you're at with a swingers club, pedophilia, people from the wrong side of the tracks. You're beginning to touch upon all the, what I kind of call the alchemy of a witch hunt, right?
Do any of the kids feel in any sense like they're getting some of their power back by telling this story?
I get the sense that they are motivated to tell their story to clear their parents' name. I think that's really my sense of, you know, because one of the things that I think is so brave of these children, well, they're adults now, is that they're admitting that they wrongly accused their parents. And I think that the motivation and the drive is because they want to see their parents, the innocence of their parents believed. And the one thing that's actually remarkable to me in this story is their parents do not blame their children. Their parents spent a lot of time in jail. These people spent a lot of time in prison for a crime they didn't commit. It was their children who put them away. And they have no ill will. They have no blame for their own children.
And it should be stated, by the way, that while that group was in jail, often they were asked by authorities to turn on the others. The parents and their circle, because there were several friends who all got caught up in this, never turned on their inner circle. They only took that plea deal when Gabby had written a suicide note. And they were like, this, and as you follow the film, the evidence was beginning to swing against the state. And I think the state was beginning to look for a way out of this. But part of this tragedy is by taking that felony deal, they got out of jail, but they were not allowed to see their children until they were 18 years old. So their children were still, at that point, 10, 11, 12. Now, what's amazing is then it's revealed that, in fact, abuse is going on in the Cantrell household against these kids. The kids get released from the Cantrells, are still not allowed to go back to their parents, but they found their way back anyway. So the bonds of that family, those families, were remarkable.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely remarkable. They all still live in the same community. and they see each other, and somehow they withstood that storm. That's part of the remarkable part of this story.
Well, How to Create a Sex Scandal debuts Tuesday, May 23rd on Max. You guys did it again. Where can people find you? Especially, you know, some people have wild stories that they want to tell, and they might see you as the best to make that story happen. How can they reach out to you and find you and find all the things that you are working on?
You can go to tellusfilms.com. It has all of our projects that we're doing, and there's some new ones coming up after this, and there's press on this and other stories, and there's a place where you can drop us a note, and we check that email all the time.
Again, congratulations on House of Hammer. Thank you again for your time. I can't wait for everyone to watch this one.
Thank you. Awesome. It was lovely to see you again. Thanks for having us.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank the great filmmakers for bringing the story to my attention and for all their hard work. And I also want to remind you to click subscribe, leave a 5-star review, join the Facebook group Reality Life with Kate Casey, because I want to hear what you think of this crazy case. You can find me on social media. I'm at Twitter, at Kate Casey, Instagram, at Kate Casey CA, and TikTok, it's Kate Casey. My must-watch list is available at katecasey.substack.com. And you want to check out my bonus episodes by going to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. Hope that you guys are having a great week, and I cannot wait to circle with you, back with you, in the next episode.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.